That's a big question. I think fundamentally, all the people who disagree one way or another would say that ultimately, that the gift for ministry, the authority to do ministry, is a gift from God. Whether you think of that as somehow coming directly through God, I think most of us are a little uncomfortable with that. Whether that's mediated through the structures of the church, as in a sort of hierarchical apostolic succession sort of thing, where that authority is channeled to a bishop and then we each have a part of it. That's one side of the argument. The other, more from below or congregational side, would say that is all mediated through the congregation, and you can find good arguments on either side of that, both in the Lutheran tradition and outside. I think the fundamental affirmation is a more simple thing. I wasn't attempting to resolve that one, but to say ultimately the gift is from God, and however it is mediated through the people and structures of the church, it remains gift rather than possession.
If it is that, and I think I would agree with that, then is there not some built-in conflict if the pastor feels that his gift comes from God and he must say some things to the congregation doesn't want to hear, then they're not necessarily giving him or her the authority at that point. The authority comes from outside that, but then the role of the authority becomes, I think, on your schema, a bit more to the left.
Someone put it to me in a conversation between things these days, the distinction between being servants of Christ or servants of these people that call you.
And sometimes both, but perhaps always.
I think both is important. Whenever you fall over on either ditch, on either side of that road, you're in big trouble. If you believe that you're in a direct shoot representative of Christ and no one can touch you, you are, the possibility of abuse is great. And so then the check and balance of being accountable to a specific congregation, and even within the Catholic tradition, which has most of that sort of direct representational understanding in the ministry. On the other side, through the best of the Catholic tradition, they have shunned absolute ordinations, but made sure that you were accountable and responsible to a particular ecclesial community. We probably lean a little on the other side, and there, where the pastor is in danger of being captive to the congregation, kept by the congregation, dependent upon them for daily bread, then I think we are very lucky in the Lutheran tradition that we have some advocate beyond the congregation, which I trust is your bishop. I think purely congregational systems have many problems in terms of being captive to the congregation. There ought to be some other force in there. And then I think it's good, while we're maintaining that kind of check and balance, that bishops are up for election every once in a while. Yeah?
Well, you said something about a perception of fear of losing when the question of ministry is raised. I've heard that said. I've heard the word threatened. Who is it that has this fear, and why?
probably a number of people in the room that could answer that. That I will share a statistic. Well, I think that what is the fear of what is being lost is a sense of status and stature and certain privileges that go with the pastoral office. In the and how that is, that's a funny question. What's in my mind to answer you with, which seems to raise the question, is I figured up enrollment statistics at the seminaries for the last 2 years. We have less people, we have more people coming to seminary, less people coming to do MDiv degrees, less people coming full time. And then you get into talking about relative numbers of men and women coming. Between 87 and 88, we had an increase of 18 women MDiv candidates throughout the 8 seminaries of the ELCA. And a decrease of 72 men. Now, that is just a kind of matter of that's just a statement of fact insofar as I can validate those figures. The reaction they seem to draw in terms of is the pastoral office changing? Is it going to become dominated by women? There seems to be hidden in that fears of general loss of status, loss of income for the profession, loss of general regard, which is a sorry commentary on our regard for women, for one thing. But that's the kind of fear that I was referring to. Am I answering your question?
I think so.
I'm in our church in the ELCA, in the kind of structuring that was done in terms of establishing quotas of representation on boards and commissions and whatnot. Certainly, male pastors have felt disenfranchised by the shifts that were made in those allocations, having less voice, less representation.
Phyllis, piggybacking on Buzz's question, it would appear that perhaps to clear up some questions regarding associates administrating, the rumors are that the CNLC had set up some standards and that those would then reversed or changed, if you could clarify the history on it. And then it would appear to be the perception of some associates in ministry that it was changed, or that the reason they weren't quote unquote grandparented in is that there are clergy types who are afraid of them for some reason, that there is a fear factor regarding associates in ministry. I don't know if you can clarify some of the misconceptions or misperceptions that are out there regarding that.
My understanding of what was agreed to in the CNLC was that those who were on the rosters of the lay ministries or ordained deacons of the predecessor church bodies would be received in for the period of the study under their present the agreements that they were and the roles they had in their predecessor church bodies. I do not believe there was a promise made beyond the end of the study. And the where we got into trouble with associates in ministry across the land is that we had an interpretation, really, from the secretary of the church that associates in ministry who became ELCA certified associates in ministry did have a guaranteed status in the church beyond the end of the study. And so we encouraged associates in ministry who were on the rosters of the predecessor churches to get busy and do whatever paperwork or additional educational work they needed to be ELCA certified in the hope that we could offer them some continuing security of that status. And we were informed later that that was not within our power to grant, that the CNLC reinterpreted, did not grant that possibility. And then it became clear that if there was no one could predict for sure for any of the lay ministries, ELCA certified or not, what would happen beyond the end of the study. It didn't seem to make sense to encourage people to go through that process. And so the emphasis turned to affirming the status that people currently have and encouraging you to hold on and have faith one more time that there will be a solution to that that does honor the ministries that you do.
So the original communique that seeking certification in the ELCA has since been changed. Because I think that was perceived as a double standard that the associates of ministry would have to be recertified if the clergy was not.
Well, and of course, they are being handled differently. Your status is up in the air for several years, which is entirely different than the clergy. But no, there is no need to be certified three times. Why is that threatening to people, to pastors? Seems like that's not. I don't know if it's part of the rules here that other people can answer. Why is the possibility of other authorized ministries being raised in the church a threat to the pastoral office?
Does the pension plan mesh in with this somewhere or the other?
Yeah, but I think what's at stake here is something more visceral than that. I think it's the sense of being special. Maybe it's like being an only child when the second child is born. There's some resentments and jealousy. But I'd like to, now that's not the kind of thing people own up to, listen to me struggle with it, but I imagine that there are clergy, bishops, pastors in the circle who could say how the emergence of lay ministers who are able to do just about everything you can do without commensurate education or might represent a threat to your office. I don't know. That makes you all bad people, I suppose, if you own up to those feelings. This is the topic of my talk in the morning, so I'm a little reluctant to shoot the whole thing. I'd be more interested to hear how it's going to go over, actually.
I was going to mention just one thing. Some of us in here in Missouri, and you had alluded this morning to the fact that you suspected that some of these concerns were going on in the other Lutheran bodies, and yes, they are.
Yes.
Just want to tell you that.
Anything in particular?
Well, apparently, I don't follow us at the convention this summer, but but the same kind of concerns about lay ministry and what role do they have in the whole picture was debated a lot. And protected by certain leaders.
Because I think it's been held up to us that the kind of status that lay teachers have in the Missouri Synod is a kind of hope or something that you have figured out better than we do.
But then there are other forms of lay ministry still in the Missouri Synod, the deacon type stuff that is very similar to.
Yes.
But that's interesting that the role of the teacher could be a model. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, for those who have come in from Missouri Synod and have become parochial school teachers, either in AELC schools or ALC schools, experienced this, I think, a significant diminishment of their recognition in this church.
I think we fear the unknown. We don't know what effect that a large core of associates in ministry will have upon the pastors and their understanding of their ministry in the congregation. And because we don't know, we generally don't think of a positive way of looking at it. We generally take the easiest way, which is a negative way, and say, well, since we don't know, it probably will be a negative effect. So it's just, some of it is just due to the psychology that we live with other things in our lives too. The question that I have is, why should we delay much longer doing something about associates in ministry when the very same statistics that you mentioned to us may indicate that there will be such a significant shortage of traditionally ordained clergymen in the parish without some kind of form of ordained or less than ordained or almost pastors will be forced upon us. My understanding is in North Dakota right now, today, they are actually training lay people to become caretakers of congregations because we can't get enough pastors to serve. So it doesn't really answer the question about why we might be afraid, but we shouldn't be afraid. We should be very grateful. Otherwise, ministry might not, it's too arrogant to say it couldn't be carried on because you didn't have enough pastors, because the Lord of the church could take care of that, I imagine. But it just seems to me that we'll need many, many, many more people who are, so they don't have 4 years of classical education in Greek and Hebrew and whatnot after their college degrees. So how smart do you have to be to work in a parish? Is academic training going to be the ticket by which we now judge whether a pastor can be a good pastor? We know lots of people that academically just, average, very average, who are excellent, excellent pastors.
So do we finally organize ministry to preserve our position, or do we organize ministry to take care of the mission needs that we're facing? And
I would say that we should shoot for the latter. We'll be preserving positions that won't be available.
But we'll probably do it slowly because of the former.
Well, we always do everything slowly for any reason.
It would be intriguing to me, in the CNLC, what occurred there in several issues may or may not represent the general feeling of the church. And it would be intriguing to me to find out in this church how many, in quotes, clergy really are threatened by that. I suspect that it would be a minority. But because of that, and because of the thing that the CNLC set up, it has to be an issue that's dealt with because they weren't able to deal with it. And so I think that perhaps we're giving a message to the church is giving an unfortunate message to the associates in ministry. that is not representative of the basic clergy of this church. But I don't know how to find that out.
Well, it probably takes time, right? One of the interesting things that happened to me in the first 6 weeks of this church is our little staff had to put together a version of the candidacy process, print a manual, and go on the road and present it to the 9 regions. And we came to the Pacific Northwest first, with our papers still flapping and things, a lot of things still up in the air. But as I remember that event, mid-January, I think, one of the pressing questions that this region asked us is, what are you going to do about associates in ministry? And it looks like this process is not set up yet for them, and it looks like you've given your attention first to the ordained clergy, and all the above was true. You know, we really were caught red-handed in a hurry and dealing with ordination first, and didn't have good answers on associates in ministry. As we moved across the country, and I don't want to fall into stereotypes, the questions about associates in ministry and their rights and their if they were being properly cared for in the church diminished steadily as we moved across the country. And nobody brought it up at all in the East, although there are plenty of associates in ministry. And the questions were more about bishops in the East. So that's, and you know, there are dangers of a stereotyping, but I think this region of the country, in my limited experience, is probably the most sensitive and caring on the issue.
Well, one of the, I don't know if this is a fear thing, but and it wasn't in a conversation about AIMS, but in the conversation of BEM and talking about the possibility of certified or ordained lay teachers, for example, in the churches. And we talked about that one of the issues that came up in the congregation where I was at the time was by the public school teachers, who immediately said, I have a calling. If these people in parochial schools are, if their status is somehow, what about us? And if we say, well, because they're working for being paid for the church, what are we saying about our whole, the ministry of the baptized?
Thank you for putting that in, because I think that is certainly one of the powerful arguments that are made, and maybe it masks something else. Maybe it's clergy protecting themselves, but many people have made the point, and it was persuasive in the CNLC, that by elevating some of the laity to a position of special prominence, it denigrates the ministry of the whole people of God. And so that is I don't want to name names, but I think that is a characteristic argument, and it's in defense of what they would say true laity. That's a helpful. That is a serious, complicating argument.
Can you explain to me the rationale why a associate minister who does not want to be on the payroll or in a pension plan or in a health benefit cannot be recognized?
That will certainly be addressed. I know where it comes from. It comes from probably not from associates in ministry at all originally. It comes from clergy managing to stay on the roster by being willing to be associated with a congregation and preach once a year or for a dollar a year pay or something while they're doing other work to maintain their association with a congregation and stay on the clergy roster. And so to guard against that abuse, I think that's where the rule of 20 hours and commensurate pay is required to be on the clergy roster. what has happened, I think for basically good-hearted reasons, has been to say, in order to gain parity for associates in ministry with clergy, they ought to fall under the same rules. So many things are just done as parallel as possible. The standards are exactly the same in the Constitution. The mobility process is supposed to be the same, handled by bishops. And I think that's one place where you probably did get grandfathered in. And I hope that as we give serious attention to this over time, and that associates in ministry, or however we name the lay ministries of the church, will indeed be able to build in more variety than we have in the pastoral office. And it won't, that there can be lay ministries that are authorized by the church that don't follow the same pattern as ordained clergy.
Thank you. One of the struggles in the planning of the synod, setting up the
power. Thank you.
One of the biggest issues was the power of the bishop, and wrestling at least in our synod. The other one, though, has a question of polity and who is going to make the decisions. And some of that, what came out of that was from the old, the LCA definition of the church and clergy, and there was some of that wrestling.
Yes.
And then, if clergy have vote, do retired clergy have vote, which is a concern? Well, if you do that, then, and you have other full-time professional people, do they then have some sort of representation, or do they, are they represented out of the, within the quotas, that whole quota system? So that became, I think, the yes. center of fear within our conversation was, to who's getting the votes? Is it going to be all the professionals getting the votes? If we're truly trying to have a lady input here, and that rather than ministry and the fear of someone challenging the ministry.
And in a kind of unfortunate coupling of events in the churchwide assembly this time, we did not grant the vote to associates in ministry, but did to pastors on leave from call, right? Hmm. It's an unfortunate combination of decisions.
Just for statistics, how many clergy and how many associates in ministry? Any numbers?
17,000 clergy, somewhere between 1,200 and 1,500 associates in ministry. And the number of church workers is uncounted. I don't know where you begin and stop on that.
Phyllis, there's a new study going on in theological education in the ELCA. Would you care to identify some of the key questions, issues that are on the agenda?
I think that's really kind of a sleeper. I think, you know, George Lindbeck may be right that what we finally come out in the study of ministry will be predictable and inconsequential. I hope not. But the study of theological education, which doesn't seem to be picked up by the Lutheran, I don't know if you even know that it's going on. We have, the Church Council has approved a proposal and 9 task force members to, over the next 6 years, taking into account what we are deciding about ministry, to decide also how we will structure and organize, fund theological education to prepare people to do those ministries. And all kinds of things are at stake. If the study of ministry should determine that this church needs and wants and is willing to educate and support armies of associates in ministries or varieties of lay ministries, it will have a major impact on what the task of seminaries are. There are people, strong voices in the church, who say seminaries should take on the responsibility for the training of laity, not only professional laity, but they ought to be much more open and develop programs for and be inclusive of people in congregations, seekers, people who just want to know more theology with no ministry goal, which is, who can be against that? But are we prepared to expand seminaries and fund them to the level that it would require to take on that kind of responsibility and do it well?
The continuing education centers wouldn't mind.
That's right.
Some of the funding that might go into doing that.
Well, the continuing education centers may be set up much better to do that task. Church colleges might be better able to do that task. And that's the kind of thing we're discussing. What may what's pressing on us now is the financial situation in seminaries. The growth of budgets of educational institutions is growing faster than the budgets of the church. That's true for colleges, and that's hitting seminaries now. At this point, from 35% to 40% of the seminary budgets are covered by direct grants from either the Division for Ministry or the synods of the church. And it's hard for us to do. We're going to fall, we have been trying to increase by 3% a year. We're going to fall behind in 90, and consequently the seminaries become less directly related financially to the church. Those are issues we need to discuss as a whole church. How the seminaries are to be related to the church, if we as a church can take on that priority, not as another project or mission of the church, but as something very close to the heart of what we're about. The Constitution set out the goal for us increasing our level of support to seminaries to 50% of their budgets, and we're going the other direction. So those are major decisions facing us, whether we can support the seminaries we have, whether synods or church-wide is the most appropriate, or the combination of the two is the most appropriate way to support seminaries, whether we are going to give up on that dream and tradition that has made Lutheran theological education rather unique in this country, and say that they'll maybe have to go their own way and develop programs that are going to be marketable and development efforts that will build endowments that will enable them to be more independent institutions. Those are big questions that will shape what our clergy is like in the future.
The church looking into any kinds of consolidation of various seminaries?
Yes, we try not to say that first, because it makes people very nervous, and to make people nervous for 6 years is very destructive on the life of those institutions. But that is part of the mandate, to look at that.
What is the rationale for not having tuition at the seminary at a higher level in order to offset the increased costs? You'll never be able to pay for, tuition will never be high enough to pay for running the seminaries completely, but it seems that tuition levels are artificially low.
They come from your college with such great debts.
My point is to get back a little bit to the first point, and I don't hear it any place expressed. If we are taking a new look at ministry and what ministry means and what that means to the church, then we ask ourselves, what is the church set about to do? Well, the church is set about to do the kinds of things we're doing now and maybe more. Well, if that is the case, then why aren't we defining sort of ex nihilo if necessary? Why are we building on a set of rubrics that have already been established that may not even have served us well up to this point? Why aren't we just dealing with what does it take to make this church grow, to make it to be the enlivened body of Christ, to make a mark upon our nation? Why don't we just say we're going to need 14,000 aims? We're going to need 2,000 people who are deacons or subdeacons, and this is what we're going to define them as. This is what it's going to take to educate them. I mean, why don't we just aggressively pursue what it's going to take to put the church on a more aggressive and therefore hopefully fulfilling the mission of Christ? And then just say this is what it's going to cost us to do this. Where's the 5-year plan? Where's the 10-year plan? Where's the any plan? We're falling into redefinition of ministry instead of aggressively assuming or aggressively tackling them and saying, this is what it's going to be. And now we may have some common elements out here. We may have some definitions that are helpful. I don't hear anybody talking like that. Is there talk like that? And if there is, where is it?
I'd like to hear more of it. One of the things that I've learned in these 2 years is that the assumptions need to be tested all the time. That what I assume, or people that came from my church or my part of the country assume, is not shared widely. And if we're going to make assumptions and move boldly forward, it's a big question whose assumptions you're going to move with. And it is bothersome at this point, but we have a big job to do yet, building consensus about where we're going.
I guess I also have a concern about, are we in the process of making the Office of Ministry the calling of pastors simply a rich man's game?
Well, that's...
The cost to go through a church college today, plus tuition to seminaries today, think of the element of the church we just cut out completely. There's no possibility of their considering that.
Many of the students that come to us directly from college are carrying debts of, you know, upwards of $10,000-$15,000. Which are not going to be easily paid off on a first call basis. And those who come as second career are usually in greater financial difficulty and have teenage children and families. So where the tuitions can be raised, there has to be raised commensurate financial aid to help cover those. And it may be a way to go, because getting money for financial aid is easier to raise than money for basic programs. So that's a possibility. In fact, the tuitions at seminaries is, we set a minimum, or the schools agree to a minimum so they don't get into a sort of a gas war competition on low tuitions. So $2,500 is the tuition for this year, but some seminaries charge more. PLTS, I believe, charges more because they're in a setting where other schools in the consortium are able to charge much higher. So they become sort of they're in danger of people going there because it's cheaper to go there. So I think PLTS is higher. Maybe somebody knows who's on the board there. Oh, that's a possibility. Putting a couple of seminaries together is a possibility. At this point, early on in the study, I can't tell you what that would actually save. Church-wide, we've put something like $40,000 a year into Philadelphia Seminary. They are sufficiently well-endowed and supported by their synods. So, if it were within our power, if it would be a good idea to close that seminary, it wouldn't free up much for other things. The cost in terms of constituent support, the kind of love that these places are regarded with, that bring in perhaps more money than the church at large can give, make it a very complicated question. Whether all the seminaries can do everything, or whether we should have seminaries that are specializing, whether we ought to designate three, four, two, whatever number of seminaries that would have a full program, including graduate programs and whatnot, and have others as more outposts. And then where do you stop having outposts? While we are struggling to try to fund the seminaries that we've got, and people everywhere say, well, you ought to close somebody else's, each region of the church presents good reasons why theological education ought to happen in this context, that there's something very special about the Southwest or the Northwest or the other areas in the country where there ought to be greater theological resources deployed, which is a good question, which could shape, could change the shape of theological education.
Phyllis, I have a question related to the, I have a question relating to that, and then a comment that comes back to the question. The question is, how do we in the Lutheran family decide what should be taught at our seminaries to make us true ministers of the gospel and authentic Lutherans? The comment is that as a member of the Missouri Synod, I graduated from Concordia Seminary, St. Louis in 1965. My opinion then was that that was an outstanding school. And in retrospect and in memory, I still feel that way. But I also feel, or say it another way, I sometimes wonder what of that experience prepared me for ministry as I know it now. And on a very personal level, I'm wondering if I were asked to come up with a seminary curriculum, how would I change the new from what I came from?
Well,
does that make sense?
Oh, it makes, yes, it makes sense. I don't know if the answer does. It is the question of the hour. I think it's true that you can't jam much more into those three academic years. And people come with a great deal less preparation than you had to begin with. People come without Hebrew, without Greek, without philosophy, maybe without history and literature. So you, for a good percentage of students, to give them the kind of classical education you had, you are doing a kind of remedial work to catch up to that point. And then the expectations of what you need to do ministry today added on the other end. If people are really going to be equipped to deal with varieties of cultures, if people are really going to be equipped to be kind of financial managers, they have to be. If people are really going to be equipped to do all that your congregations expect of you, it adds on probably more coursework also than you had. So that seems to be bankrupt. It's easier to get agreement on what ought to be added than what ought to be left out. People everywhere I go have an idea of a course, you know, that every pastor ought to have a course in ecology, or every pastor ought to have a course in stewardship, or every pastor ought to have this or that. It's very hard to get three people to agree on whether you should have half as much church history, or maybe you don't really need Greek, or you know, those are Those are tough decisions, and then you get in faculties who finally make those decisions with vested interests and careers on the line, and these become very difficult political decisions to make. Where I see hope, and I don't know if any of these various studies that we've put in the hands of other people, you know, I would hope that our continuing education centers and our synods would take a more forceful and assigned role in education beyond the three academic years. There are a lot of things that you need to know that are not learned well in a seminary classroom, that could be learned with a mentor or under within the first 3 years of your parish experience. If you were required to do a continuing curriculum that dealt with real-life pastoral issues, when you're in a frame of mind and a context in which you are highly educable, it's that kind of expansion that I see as hopeful. I would be very reluctant to diminish any more the academic input in those years.
Do you have a parallel in the medical profession there? Well, it's the same kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
And it's a little like European theological education.
So I mean, with a matter of salary, too. If you become a specialist, you should have a higher salary.
Year might make more sense to give 3 solid years of academic training and then continuing serious work in a parish setting.
A couple of quick comments on this. I think that continuing education could do far more in trying to work out some kind of curriculum maybe for the first 5 years after one has moved from seminary into parish ministry. I'm not sure we could agree on what that syllabus might look like. I mean, that'd be a real tough struggle. Some of us have tried to dream that up, and very little agreement on that. Nevertheless, I think one could come closer, at least, to some options that people could have.
And it seems to me that there's more possibility for regional particularity at that level than in the basic academic core. So if ministry really does have a special flavor in the Southwest and pastors all there should know how to speak Spanish or whatever, that could be part of that continuing work.
I guess the other comment I would have is that I think the curriculum in our seminaries is good. I think it's helpful for ministry. I think, though, there's simply too much abstraction in seminary education and not enough vocational application of what's going on in the classroom. It just seems to me that there's no way that classes should get by without having the term paper or the examinations or things like that that don't immediately focus from the topic to now. What does this actually say about pastoral ministry? What are you going to do it? And it seems too often that question is sort of left up in the air.
And the answers you'll get is time constraints and whatever. But to return to something elicits in me, I would like to see that happen. Part of my anxiety about the seminaries taking on a wider range of responsibilities for lay ministries and for the general edification of the church is the specific formation for pastoral ministry gets either we learn to give that kind of very special attention or it gets diluted. That kind of program you're talking about is very vocationally centered. And one of the forces that we need to consider, because people are bringing it forward, is whether our seminaries should be as vocationally centered as they are, or open to, whether they're going to be fixated on the clerical paradigm, is the kind of language people will use.
I think that this whole question that we are talking about now goes back to the role of the minister. What is it? Should we be trained to take care of the finances of the church? Should we take care of the plumbing of the church? You know, I think there's a million of different tasks that we could prepare ourselves, and you know, sometimes we need all those people. But I would still vote for the idea that the minister should be the expert in theological issues, who would be able to provide the congregants with all the facts. It's intriguing, at least to me, to talk to brothers and sisters and ask if you ever had a class in the seminary on God, and very few have had. It sounds to me kind of funny that, you know, this is the theology is after all about God, and we don't have a course on God. And so I suppose we should first try to figure out, well, what is the role of the pastor? What is he supposed to be, or is he supposed to be?
I would find that very hard to believe, that people going through Lutheran theological education haven't had probably a three-course sequence or something on the first, second, third article of the Creed. I think we're still doing the doctrine of God in our seminaries. I think we can say that much.
Well, what I mean by this is that you know, we touch these issues, yes. But if you just have a class on the term or the concept of God, what does it mean? You know, that is something that we don't have.
Don't we have?
I think there's a chance to, you know, think about some of the things that Pastor Newcomb was saying, and what, you know, Walt's saying. Instead of trying to train pastors to do everything, why not prepare pastors to preach and teach, and have them take care of preach and teach in three or four congregations, and have whatever we determine to call people who are our catechists and some other things, and send them out in for two or three congregations, pay them the same, and give them titles that have equal status, and you know, just one person does word and sacrament.
Yeah, that's that's basically what I'm going to suggest tomorrow. Now it looks like I went. Oh, I think that is a hopeful direction to go. That there are, and that's really honoring the gifts of, there are a lot of people who can do those things better than you can.
One more question, and I think we're going to call it an evening.
Is it necessarily true that all congregations are going to be able to afford the multiple staffs that assumes then?
Well, if they share one pastor between five or six congregations, they might be able to have others. But that is a real question. As we raise up lay leaders, the church can say, we want you, but it's a second question whether congregations are going to be willing, able, committed to pay commensurate salaries and benefits and honor those ministers with the same kind of integrity as they do pastors.
It is likely that the issue is not going to be finally decided by your group, but by what the people in the parish are going to accept.
And it will happen in church basements.
Yeah, and as you talk about this idea that you're speaking about, what comes to my mind is that, at least in the parish that I just left, most people want to have the person who preaches to them be the same person who visits them in the hospital and cares for them when they're grieving. I mean, there's some sort of intimate connection between their daily life and their worship life, and it's hard to fragment that out and give one to a different specialist.
Yes, it is. But I don't know whether we are going to be able to afford that in every community of 150 people. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
What are the statistics? Do you have the prognostication for the future? How many pastors are we going to have? How many pastors are we going to be short? Someone says, well, we're going to be short 2,000 people. Another bishop says, that's nonsense. I got 2,000 people waiting for call to come into this district or whatever. I mean, what is the truth about this thing? Have you any statistical data that at least points
to? No, but we've started at the, correct me if I'm wrong, at the assignment to regions last year, are any bishops who attended that here? We had 302 candidates available, and the number of first calls available was considerably more than that. I think it was like two candidates for every three positions.
About 60, we got about 69%.
So that's the situation at this point. Whether that's a fluke or how far that goes, we've got a lot of work to do. I think there's going to be a long time before there's a big shortage in Seattle. It is spotty in terms of where people are able or willing to go. But as you pointed out, there is severe shortage in North Dakota.
But then we don't address that in a business-like way either. If you get sent up to northern Alaska and your compensation is doubled, maybe it's tripled, not as a pastor, but as a person working in an oil field, for example, because of the so-called hardship issue. If you get assigned to Montana, you have to be content with a lower salary and have other congregations contribute to your livelihood so you can survive. Are we being as wise as the people of this world sometimes?
Not yet.
Not yet.
Thank you, Phyllis.